Chapter 23. Francis. It was now day 4 of the retreat. Francis found she had settled into the gentle rhythm of life at Tranquillum House with surprising ease. She rarely had to make decisions about how to spend her time. Every morning began with Tai Chi in the Rose Garden with Yao. Her schedule always included at least one, sometimes two, remedial massages with Jan. Some days she had to go to the spa on multiple occasions, if, for example, she was assigned a facial. She did not find this onerous. The facials were divinely scented, dreamlike experiences that left Frances rosy and glowing, with her hair sticking up like the petals of a flower. There were yoga classes in the yoga and meditation studio, and walking meditations through the surrounding bushland. The walking meditations got brisker and faster and steeper each day. In the early evening, when it got cooler, some guests went running with Yao. The Marconi family seemed to do nothing but run, even during free time. Frances would sit on her balcony and watch the three of them pelting up Tranquility Hill as if they were running for their lives. While others did a gentle exercise class in the Rose Garden with Delilah. Delilah seemed to have made it her personal mission to get Frances to do push-ups on her toes like a man. And because Frances wasn't allowed to speak, she couldn't say, "No, thank you, I've never seen the point of push-ups." She now understood that the point of push-ups was to work every muscle in her body, which was supposedly a good thing. Frances meekly allowed Yao to take her blood and check her blood pressure each day, before hopping mutely on the scales so he could record her weight, which she still avoided looking at, but which she assumed was plummeting, probably in free fall, what with all the exercise and the lack of calories and wine. The noble silence, which seemed so flimsy and silly in the beginning, so arbitrary and easily breakable, somehow gained in strength and substance as the days passed, like the settling in of a heat wave. And in fact, the summer heat had intensified. It was a dry, still heat, bright and white, like the silence itself. At first, without the distraction of noise and conversation, Frances's thoughts went around and around on a crazy, endless, repetitive loop. Paul Drabble, the money she'd lost, the surprise, the hurt, the anger, the surprise, the hurt, the anger, Paul's son, who was probably not even his son, the book she'd written with delusional love in her heart, which had subsequently been rejected, the career that was possibly over, the review that she should never have read. It wasn't that she'd found any solutions or experienced any earth-shattering revelations, but the act of observing her looping thoughts seemed to slow them down, until at last they came to a complete stop. And she'd found that for moments of time she thought nothing. Nothing at all. Her mind was quite empty. And those moments were lovely. The other guests were silent, not unwelcome figures in her peripheral vision. It became perfectly normal to ignore people, to not say hello when you found someone else sitting in the hot spring you were visiting, but to instead step silently into the bubbling, eggy-scented water with your head averted. Once, she and the tall, dark and handsome man sat in the secret grotto hot spring for what seemed like an eternity together, neither saying a word, both gazing out at the valley views, lost in their private thoughts. Even though they hadn't spoken or even looked at each other, It felt like they'd shared something spiritual. There had been other pleasant surprises too. For example, yesterday afternoon, as she had passed Zoe on the stairs, the girl brushed against her and pressed something into the palm of her hand. Frances managed to keep her eyes ahead and not say anything, which was remarkable, as she was very bad at that sort of thing. Both her ex-husbands had informed her that they could think of no one who would make a worse spy than her, while they, in spite of their differing personalities, were both apparently eminently qualified to join the CIA at a moment's notice. And when she got to her room, she had found a Reese's peanut butter cup in her hand. She had never tasted anything more divine. Apart from Zoe, Frances didn't have much interaction with anyone else. She no longer startled when Napoleon sneezed. She noted that Tony's hacking cough gradually lessened and lessened until it disappeared, and indeed her own cough disappeared around the same time. Her breathing became beautifully clear. Her paper cut vanished, and her back pain got better every day. It really was a healing journey. When she got home, she was going to send Ellen an effusive thank you card for suggesting this place. According to today's schedule, she had a one-on-one counseling session with Marcia straight after lunch. Frances had never had any form of counseling in her life. She had friends for that. They all counseled each other, and it was generally a two-way process. Frances couldn't imagine sitting and telling anyone her problems without then listening to their problems and offering her own sage advice in return. She generally felt that the advice she offered was superior to the advice she received. Other people's problems were so simple. One's own problems tended to be so much more nuanced. But the silence and the heat and the daily massages had all combined to create a peaceful sense of resignation. Marcia could counsel Frances if it made her happy. Frances's lunch that day was a vegetarian curry. She had stopped noticing the sound of everyone chewing and had begun to take the most extraordinary pleasure in her food. Extraordinary because she thought she already took quite substantial pleasure in her food. The curry, which she savoured tiny mouthful by tiny mouthful, had a hint of saffron that just about blew her mind. Was saffron always that good? She didn't know, but it felt like a religious experience. After lunch, while still reflecting on the wonder of saffron, Frances opened the door marked private, then climbed up two flights of stairs to the Princess Tower at the top of the house and knocked on the door of Marcia's office. "Come in," said a voice, a little peremptorily. Frances entered the room, reminded of visits to the principal's office when she was at boarding school. Marcia was writing something down, and she gestured towards the seat in front of her to indicate that Frances should sit while she finished what she was doing. Her demeanour would normally have made Frances bristle, and she wasn't yet quite so zen that she didn't note the fact that she had the right to bristle. She was the paying guest, turning up at the appointed time, thank you very much, not the hired help. But she didn't sigh or clear her throat or wriggle because she was very nearly transformed. Definitely thinner, and yesterday she did 2 push-ups in a row on her toes. She'd probably look very similar to Marcia quite soon. A wave of laughter rose in her chest, and she distracted herself by studying the room. She'd love an office like this. If she had an office like this, she would probably write a masterpiece without chocolate. There were huge glass windows on all four sides, giving Marcia a 360-degree view of the soft, rippling green countryside. It looked like a Renaissance painting from up here. In the same way that the silence didn't apply to Marcia, it seemed that neither did the no electronic devices rule. Marcia did not seem averse to the very latest in technology. She had not one, but two very smart-looking oversized computer monitors on her desk, as well as a laptop. Was she surfing the internet up here while all her guests digitally detoxed? Frances felt her right hand twitch. She imagined grabbing a mouse, spinning a monitor around to face her, and clicking on a news site. What had happened in the last 4 days? There could have been a zombie apocalypse or a significant celebrity couple breakup, and Frances would have no idea. She dragged her eyes away from the seductive computer screens and looked instead at the few items on Marcia's desk. No photo frames revealing anything personal. There were a few lovely antiques that Frances coveted. Her hand crept out to touch a letter opener. The gold handle had an intricate design with pictures of elephants. "Careful," said Marcia. "That letter opener is as sharp as a dagger. You could murder someone with that, Frances." Frances's hand flew back as fast as a shoplifter's. Marcia picked up the letter opener and removed it from its sheath. "It is at least 200 years old, she said. She pressed her thumb to the sharp point. "It has been in my family for a long time." Frances made an interested murmur. She wasn't sure if she was allowed to break the silence, and suddenly she was irritated by that. "I assume the noble silence doesn't apply right now," she said, and her unused voice sounded strange and unfamiliar to her ears. She'd been so good. She hadn't even talked to herself when she was alone in her room. And normally she was very chatty when alone, cheerfully narrating her own actions and engaging in friendly dialogue with inanimate objects. "Where are you hiding, O peeler of carrots?" "Ah, you are a person who likes to follow the rules, are you?" Marcia rested her chin in both hands and studied her. Her eyes really were a remarkable shade of green. "Generally," said Frances. Marcia didn't break eye contact. "As I'm sure you know, I did have some banned items in my luggage," said Frances. She was happy with her cool tone, but her face was hot. "Yes," said Marcia, "I am aware of that." "And I'm still reading," said Frances defiantly. "Are you?" said Marcia. "Yes," said Frances. "Anything good?" Marcia replaced the letter opener on her desk. Frances thought about this. The book was meant to be another murder mystery, but the author had introduced far too many characters too early, and so far everyone was still alive and kicking. The pace had slowed. "Come on now, hurry up and kill someone." "It's quite good," she told Marcia. "Tell me, Frances," said Marcia, "do you want to be a different person when you leave here?" "Well," said Frances. She picked up a colored glass ball from Marcia's desk. It felt vaguely bad-mannered. You didn't pick up other people's belongings. And yet, she couldn't help it. She wanted to feel the cool weight of it in her hand.
I guess I do.
I don't think you do, said Masha. I think you are here for a little rest, and you are quite happy with the way you are now. I think this is all a little bit of a joke to you. You prefer not to take things too seriously in your life. Yes? Her accent had deepened. Frances reminded herself that this woman had no authority over her.
Does it matter if I'm just here for a little rest?
Frances put the glass ball back down and pushed it away from her, causing a moment's panic when it began to roll. She stopped it with her fingertips and placed her hands in her lap. This was ridiculous. Why did she feel ashamed, like a teenager? This was a health resort. Masha didn't answer her question.
I wonder, do you feel that you've ever been truly tested in your life?
Frances shifted in her seat. I've suffered losses, she said defensively. Masha flicked her hand.
Of course you have, she said. You are 52 years old. That is not my question.
I've been lucky, said Frances. I know I have been very lucky.
And you live in the lucky country.
Masha lifted her arms to encompass the countryside that surrounded them.
Well, that phrase about us being the lucky country, it's kind of misused.
Frances heard a pedantic tone creep into her voice, and she wondered why she was parroting her first husband, Sol, who always felt the need to point this out smugly when someone referred to Australia as being the lucky country. The author who wrote that phrase meant to imply that we hadn't earned our prosperity.
So, Australia is not so lucky?
Well, no, we are, but...
Frances stopped. Was that exactly the point that Masha was trying to make? That Frances hadn't earned her prosperity?
You never had children, said Masha, referring to an open file on the desk in front of her.
Frances found herself craning to look as if her file would reveal a secret. Masha only knew she didn't have children because Frances had indicated that when she filled in the booking form.
Was that decision made by choice, or was it forced upon you by circumstance?
Choice, said Frances. This is none of your business, lady. She thought of Ari and the PlayStation games he was going to show her when she got to America. Where was Ari now? Or the boy who pretended to be Ari? Was he on the phone to some other woman?
I see, said Masha.
Did Masha think she was selfish for not wanting children? It wouldn't be the first time she'd heard that accusation. It had never especially bothered her.
Do you have children?
Frances asked Masha. She was allowed to ask questions. This woman was not her therapist. She probably had no qualifications whatsoever. She leaned forward, curious to know, are you in a relationship?
I am not in a relationship, and I do not have children, said Masha.
She had become very still. She looked very steadily at Frances, so steadily that Frances couldn't help but wonder if she was lying, although it was impossible to imagine Masha in a relationship. She could never be half of any relationship.
You mentioned losses, said Masha. Tell me about those losses.
My father died when I was very young,
said Francis. Mine also, said Marcia. Francis was taken aback by this unasked-for personal revelation. I'm sorry, said Francis. She thought of her last memory of her dad. It had been summer, a Saturday. She was going out to her part-time job as a checkout girl at Target. He was sitting in their living room, playing Hot August Night, smoking a cigarette, eyes closed, and humming along with deep feeling to Neil Diamond, whom he considered to be a genius. Francis kissed him on the forehead. See you, darling, he said, without opening his eyes. For her, the smell of cigarettes was the smell of love. She dated far too many smokers for that reason. A lady driving a car didn't stop at a pedestrian crossing, said Frances. The sun was in her eyes. My father was going for a walk. My father was shot in the market by a hitman for the Russian mafia, said Marcia. Also an accident. They thought he was someone else. Seriously? Francis tried not to look too avid for more exotic detail. Marcia shrugged. My mother said my father had too common a face, too plain, like anybody's, like everybody's. She was very angry with him for his plain face. Francis didn't know whether to smile. Marcia didn't smile, so Francis didn't either. Francis offered up, My mother was angry with my father for going for a walk. For years, she said, it was so hot that day. Why didn't he just stay inside like a normal person? Why did he have to walk everywhere? Marcia nodded, just once. My father should not have been at the market, she said. He was a very clever man. He had a very senior position for a firm that made vacuum cleaners. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, when inflation went, she made a whistling motion and pointed up, our entire savings gone. My father's company could not pay him cash. They paid him in vacuum cleaners. So he went to the market to sell the vacuum cleaners. He should not have had to do that. It was beneath him. That's awful, said Francis. For a moment, it felt as if the giant chasm that separated their different cultures and childhoods and body types could be bridged by the commonality of the loss of their fathers, through terrible chance, and their bitter, grieving mothers. But then Marcia sniffed, as if suddenly disgusted by some unmentionable behavior. She closed the file in front of her. Well, it has been nice to chat with you, Francis, to get to know you a little bit. She made it sound as if she now knew everything there was to know about Francis. How did you end up in Australia? Asked Francis, suddenly desperate for the conversation not to end. She didn't want to go back to the silence now she'd experienced the pleasure of human interaction, and it was fine if Marcia didn't want to know more about Francis, but Francis most certainly wanted to know more about her. My ex-husband and I applied to different embassies, said Marcia coldly. The U.S., Canada, Australia. I wanted the U.S., my husband wanted Canada, but Australia wanted us. Frances tried not to take this personally, although she had a feeling that Marcia wanted her to take it personally.
also ex-husband. They had divorce in common too. But Frances could tell she wouldn't get anywhere trying to exchange divorce stories. There was something about Marcia that reminded Frances of a friend from university who had been both deeply egocentric and deeply insecure. The only way to make her open up was with flattery, extremely careful flattery. It was like dismantling a bomb. You could accidentally offend them at any time. I think it's a very brave thing to do, said Frances, to start a new life in a new country.
Well, we did not have to travel the open seas in a rickety boat, if that's what you are thinking. The Australian government paid our airfares, picked us up at the airport, paid for our accommodation. You needed us. We were both very intelligent people. I had a degree in mathematics. My husband was a talented world-class scientist.
Her eyes looked back into a past Frances longed to see.
Extremely talented.
The way she said extremely talented didn't make her sound like a divorced wife. She sounded like a widow.
We're lucky you came then, said Frances humbly, on behalf of the Australian people.
Yes, you are very lucky, said Marcia. She leaned forward, her face suddenly alight. I'll tell you why we came. Because of a VCR. It all starts with the VCR. And now nobody even has a VCR. Technology.
The VCR? Said Frances.
Our neighbors in the flat next to ours got one. Nobody could afford such a thing. They inherited money from a relative who died in Siberia. These neighbors were good friends of ours, and they asked us over to see movies.
Her gaze became unfocused, once again remembering. Frances didn't move. She didn't want Marcia to stop this sudden sharing of confidences. It was like when your uptight boss goes to the pub with you and loosens up over a drink and suddenly starts chatting to you, like you're an equal.
It was a window into another world, into a capitalist world. It all seemed so different, so amazing, so abundant.
Marcia smiled dreamily.
Dirty dancing, desperately seeking Susan, the breakfast club. Not that many because the movies were insanely expensive, so people had to swap them. The voices were all done by the same person, holding his nose to disguise his voice because it was illegal.
She held her nose and spoke in a nasal voice to demonstrate.
If it wasn't for that VCR, for those movies, we might not have worked so hard to leave. It was not easy to leave.
Did the reality live up to your expectations? Asked Frances, thinking of the glossy, highly colored world of 80s films and how bland suburban Sydney would feel when she and friends emerged blinking from the cinemas. Was it as wonderful as in the movies?
It was as wonderful, said Marcia.
She picked up the glass ball that Frances had put down and held it in the flat palm of her hand, as if daring it to roll. It stayed completely still.
And it was not.
She put the ball back down decisively. Suddenly, she seemed to remember her superior status, like when your boss remembers you have to work together the next day.
So, Frances, Tomorrow, we will officially break the silence, and you will get to know the other guests. I'm looking forward. Enjoy your evening meal, because there will be no meals served at all tomorrow. Your first light fast will begin.
She held out her hand in such a way that Frances found herself automatically rising to her feet.
Have you done much fasting before?
Marcia looked up at her. She said, fasting, as if it were an exotic, delightful practice, like belly dancing.
Not really, admitted Frances, but it's just a light fast, right?
Marcia smiled radiantly.
You may find tomorrow a little testing, Frances.
Chapter 24. Carmel.
You have already lost some weight, I see.
Marcia opened Carmel's file to begin her counseling session.
Have I? Said Carmel. She felt like she'd won a prize. How much?
Marcia ignored the question. She ran her finger down a sheet of paper in the file.
I thought I might have lost some, but I wasn't sure.
Carmel heard her unused voice tremble with pleasure. She hadn't dared to hope. It seemed that Yao deliberately stood in such a way that she couldn't see that dreaded number on the scales each day. She put a hand to her stomach. She had suspected it was getting flatter, her clothes looser. She'd been secretly touching her stomach, like when she was pregnant for the first time. This retreat was just like that euphoric time. The feeling that her body was changing in new and miraculous ways.
I guess I'll probably lose even more when we start the fast tomorrow.
Carmel wanted to demonstrate her enthusiasm and commitment to the retreat.
She would do whatever it took.
Marcia said nothing. She closed Carmel's file and balanced her chin on her folded hands.
Carmel said, I hope it's not just fluid loss. They say that in the first few days of a diet, you mostly just lose fluid.
Marcia still said nothing.
I know the meals here are all calorie controlled. I guess the challenge will be maintaining my weight loss when I go home. I'd be really grateful for any nutrition advice you can give me going forward. Maybe a recipe plan?
You do not need a recipe plan, said Marcia. You are an intelligent woman. You know what to do to lose weight, if that's what you want. You are not especially fat. You are not especially thin. You want to be thinner. That is your choice. I find this not so interesting.
Oh, said Carmel.
Sorry. Tell me something about yourself that is not related to your weight, said Marcia.
Well, I have four daughters, said Carmel.
She smiled at the thought of them. They're aged 10, 8, 7, and 5.
I know this already. You are a mother, said Marcia. Tell me something else.
My husband left me. He has a new girlfriend now, so that's been...
Marcia waved that away irritably, as if it were of no relevance.
Something else.
There is nothing else right now, said Carmel. There's no time for anything else. I'm just a normal, busy mum. An overweight, stressed-out, suburban mum.
As she spoke, she scanned Marcia's desk for family photos.
She must not have children. If she did, she would know how motherhood swallowed you up whole.
I work part-time, she tried to explain. I have an elderly mother who is not well. I am always tired, always, always tired.
Marcia sighed, as if Carmel were not behaving.
I know I need to work more exercise into my schedule, offered Carmel. Was that what she wanted to hear?
Yes, said Marcia. Yes, you do. But I find this also not so interesting.
When the kids are older, I'll have more time to
tell me about when you were a schoolgirl,
interrupted Marcia. What were you like? Smart? Top of the class, bottom of the class. Naughty, loud, shy.
I was mostly near the top of the class, said Carmel.
Always.
Not naughty, not shy, not loud. She thought about it. Although, I could be very loud if I felt strongly about something. She remembered a heated argument with a teacher who wrote, "The thunder boomed, the lightning flashed," on the blackboard. Carmel stood up to correct the teacher's spelling of lightning. The teacher didn't believe her. Carmel wouldn't back down, even when the teacher yelled at her. She was all-powerful when she knew without doubt she was in the right. But how often did you know for sure that you were right?
Hardly ever. Interesting, said Marcia, because right now you do not seem like a very loud person.
You should see me in the morning when I yell at my kids, said Carmel.
Why have I not seen this loud Carmel? Where is she?
We're not allowed to speak?
That is a good point. But see, even then, when you made a very valid point, you said it like a question. You put this questioning sound at the end of your sentences, like this. Your voice goes up, like you are not really sure of everything you say?
Carmel squirmed at Marcia's imitation of her speech patterns.
Was that really how she sounded?
And your walk, said Marcia. That is the other thing. I don't like the way you walk.
You don't like the way I walk? Spluttered Carmel. Wasn't that kind of rude?
Marcia stood and came out from behind her desk.
This is how you walk right now.
She rounded her shoulders, dropped her chin, and did a scurrying kind of sidestep across the room.
Like you are hoping no one sees you. Why do you do that?
Don't think I exactly...
Yes, you do.
Marcia sat back down.
I don't think you always walked like this. I think once you walked properly. Do you want your daughters to walk like you walk?
It was obviously a rhetorical question. You are a woman. In the prime of your life, you should march into a room with your head held high, like you are walking onto a stage, a battlefield.
Carmel stared.
I'll try, she said. She coughed and remembered to turn it into a statement. I will try. I will try to do that.
Marcia smiled.
Good. At first, it will feel strange. You will have to fake it. But then, you will remember. You will think,
Oh, that's right. This is how I talk. This is how I walk. This is me, Caramel.
She knocked her closed fist against her heart.
This is who I am.
She leaned forward and lowered her voice.
I will tell you a secret.
Her eyes danced.
You will look thinner if you walk like that.
Carmel smiled back.
Was she joking?
Everything will become clearer over the next few days, said Marcia.
With a gesture that made Carmel stand up quickly, as if she'd outstayed her welcome. Marcia pulled a notepad towards her and began to write something down. Carmel hovered. She tried to put her shoulders back.
Could you just tell me how much weight I've lost so far?
Marcia didn't look up.
Close the door behind you.
Chapter 25. Marcia.
Marcia studied the large man who sat on the other side of her desk, his feet planted solidly on the floor, his hands curled in meaty fists on his thighs, as if he were a prisoner hoping for parole. Marcia remembered how Delilah had implied there was something unusual or secretive about Tony Hogburn. Marcia did not agree. The man was not especially complex. He seemed to her to be a simple, grumpy fellow. He had lost weight already. Men who drank a lot of beer always did lose weight when they stopped. Whereas women like Carmel, who had much less weight to lose, took much longer. In truth, Carmel hadn't lost any weight at all. But there was no benefit in Carmel hearing that.
How did you come across Tranquillum House, Tony?
Marcia asked him. I googled how to change your life, said Tony.
Ah, said Marcia.
As an experiment, she sat back, crossed her legs, and waited for his eyes to travel down her body, which they did, of course. The man was not dead yet, but not for very long.
Why do you want to change your life?
Well, Marcia, life is short.
His gaze moved past hers to the window behind her head. Marcia noted that he seemed much calmer and more confident now than when he had complained about his contraband being confiscated. The positive effects of Tranquillum House.
I didn't want to waste the time I had left.
He looked back at her.
I like your office. It's like you're on top of the world up here. I get claustrophobic down in that yoga studio.
So, how do you hope to change your life?
I just want to get healthier and fitter, said Tony. Drop some weight.
Men often use that phrase, drop some weight. They said it without shame or emotion, as if the weight were an object they could easily put down when they chose. Women said they needed to lose weight with their eyes down, as if the extra weight was part of them, a terrible sin they'd committed.
I used to be very fit. I should have done this sooner. I really regret.
Tony stopped, cleared his throat, as if he'd said more than he wanted.
What do you regret? Asked Marcia.
It's not anything I've done. It's more everything I haven't done. I've just kind of moped about for 20 years.
It took a fraction of a second to translate the English word moped. A word she didn't hear much.
20 years is a long time to mope, said Masha.
Foolish man. She herself had never moped, not once. Moping was for the weak.
I kind of got into the habit of it, said Tony. Not sure how to stop.
She waited to hear what he would say next. Women liked to be asked questions about themselves, but with men it was better to be patient, to be silent, and see what eventuated. She waited. The minutes passed. She was considering giving up when Tony shifted in his chair.
Your near-death experience, he said, without looking at her. You said you no longer feared death, or something like that?
That's right, said Masha. She studied him, wondering about his interest in this subject. I no longer fear it. It was beautiful. People think death is like falling asleep, but for me, it was like waking up.
A tunnel? Said Tony. Is that what you saw? A tunnel of light?
Not a tunnel.
She paused, considered changing the subject and putting the focus back on him. She had already revealed too much of her personal life earlier to that Frances Welty, with her bouncy hair and red lipstick, nearly knocking Masha's glass ball off the desk like a child, asking her greedy, nosy questions, making Masha forget her position. It was hard to believe Frances was exactly the same age as Masha. She reminded Masha of a little girl in her second grade class, a plump, pretty, vain little girl who always had a pocket filled with Vzlotnaya candies. People like Frances lived candy-filled lives. But she did not feel that Tony had lived a candy-filled life.
It was not a tunnel. It was a lake, she told him, a great lake of shimmering, colored light.
She had never told a guest this before. She had told Yao about it, but not Delilah. As Tony ran a hand over his unshaven jaw, considering her words, Masha saw again that incredible lake of color, scarlet, turquoise, lemon. She hadn't just seen that lake. She had experienced it with all her senses. She had breathed it, heard it, smelled it, tasted it.
Did you see loved ones? Asked Tony.
No, lied Masha. Even as she saw an image of a young man walking towards her through the lake of light, color streaming off him like water. Such an ordinary but exquisite young man. He wore a baseball cap, like so many young men did. He took it off and scratched his head. She had only ever seen him as her baby, her beautiful, fat-cheeked, toothless baby. But she knew immediately that this was her son. This was the man he would have and should have become. And all that love was still within her, as fresh and powerful and shocking
as it had been when she'd held him for the first time. She did not know if it had been a precious gift or a cruel punishment to have experienced that love again. Perhaps it was both. She saw her son for what could have been a lifetime or what could have been a few seconds. She had no concept of time. And then he was gone, and she floated near her office ceiling, above the two men working on her lifeless body. She could see a button on the floor where they had ripped open her silk shirt. She could see one of her legs splayed at a strange angle, as if she'd landed there after falling from a great height. She could see the top of another young man's head, the white part in his dark hair, revealing a tiny strawberry-shaped birthmark, the dampness of his forehead as he sent electrical pulses through her body, and somehow she felt everything he felt, his fear, his focus. Her next conscious memory had been the following day. She was back in the drab confines of her body, and a tall, beautiful nurse was saying, "Hello there, Sleeping Beauty." It was like being returned to jail. Except it wasn't a nurse. This woman was the doctor who had performed her heart surgery, a quadruple bypass. In the years to come, Masha often considered how her life would have been different if her heart surgeon had looked like the vast majority of heart surgeons. Her prejudices would have made her dismiss everything he had to say, no matter the accuracy. She would have put him in the same category as the gray-haired men who worked for her. She knew better than all of them. But this woman made Masha snap to attention. She felt strangely proud of her. She too was a woman at the top of her profession in a man's world, and she was tall. It somehow mattered that she was tall, like Masha. So Masha listened attentively as she talked about reducing her risk factors when it came to diet and exercise and smoking. And she listened when the doctor said, "Don't let your heart be a casualty of your head." She wanted Masha to understand that her state of mind was just as important as the state of her body. When I was on the wards in my first term of cardiac surgery, we had something called the beard sign, she said, meaning that if one of our male patients was so miserable he couldn't even be bothered to shave, his chances of recovery were not as good. You must take care of your whole self, Masha. Masha shaved her legs the very next day for the first time in years. She went to the cardiac rehabilitation exercise program suggested by the doctor, determined to top the class. She attacked the challenge of her health and her heart in the same way that she had once attacked challenges at work. And, naturally, she overachieved, beyond all expectations. "Good God," said the surgeon when Masha went to her for her first checkup. She had never once moped. She recreated herself. She did it for the tall, attractive doctor. She did it for the young man in the lake. "My sister also had a near-death experience," said Tony, "a horse-riding accident.
After her accident, she changed. Her career, everything about her life, she got right into gardening. He gave Marcia an uneasy look. I didn't like it.
You don't like gardening? Said Marcia, teasing a little.
He gave her a half smile, and she saw a flash of a more attractive man.
I think I just didn't want my sister to change, he said. It felt like she'd become a stranger. Maybe it felt like she'd experienced something I couldn't understand.
People are frightened of what they don't understand, said Marcia. I never believed in life after death before that. Now I do. And I live a better life because of it.
Right, said Tony.
Yeah. Again, Marcia waited. Anyway, Tony exhaled and patted his thighs, as if he were done. Marcia would get nothing else of interest out of him. It did not matter. The next 24 hours would tell her so much more about this man. He would learn things he did not know about himself. A glorious sense of calm settled upon her as she watched him leave the room, hitching up his pants with one hand. Those last remnants of doubt were gone. Maybe it was because of the thoughts of her son. The risks were calculated. The risks were justified. No one ever ascended a mountain without risk. Chapter 26. Napoleon. It was dawn at Tranquillum House, the fifth day of the retreat. Napoleon parted the wild horse's mane three times, both sides. He enjoyed the soft swooping moves of Tai Chi, and this was one of his favorite moves, although he heard his knees crunch like a tire on gravel as he bent his legs. His physio said it was nothing to worry about. People Napoleon's age crunched. It was just middle-aged cartilage. Yao led this morning's class in the rose garden, quietly and calmly naming each move for the nine guests who stood in a semicircle around him, all wearing their green Tranquillum House dressing gowns. People seem to be wearing the robes more often than not now. On the horizon behind Yao, two hot air balloons ascended so slowly above the vineyards, it looked like a painting. Napoleon and Heather had done that once, on a romantic weekend away, wine tasting, antique shops, multiple lives ago, before children. It was interesting. When you have children, you think your life has changed forever, and it's true, to an extent. But it's nothing compared to how your life changes after you lose a child. When Marcia, an extraordinarily fit and healthy-looking woman, clearly passionate about what she did, his wife mistrusted passion, and Zoe was still young enough to find it embarrassing, but Napoleon found it admirable, had spoken on the first day about how this experience would change them in ways they could never have imagined. Napoleon, once a believer in self-improvement, had felt an unusual sensation of bitter cynicism. He and his family had already been transformed in ways they could never have imagined. All they needed was peace and quiet, and certainly an improvement in their diets.
While I admire and salute your passion, Marcia, we do not seek or desire further transformation.
The white crane spreads its wings, said Yao, and everyone moved in graceful unison with him. It was quite beautiful to see. Napoleon, who stood at the back, as always, he'd learned to stand at the back of every audience once he hit 6'3", watched his wife and daughter lift their arms together. They both bit their bottom lips like chipmunks when they concentrated. He heard the knees of the guy next to him crunch too, which was pleasing because Napoleon guessed he was at least a decade younger than him. Even Napoleon could see this guy was notably handsome. He looked at Heather to see if she was maybe checking out the good-looking guy, but her eyes were opaque, like a doll's eyes. As usual, she was somewhere deep and sad within herself. Heather was broken. She had always been fragile, like a piece of delicate china. Early on in their relationship, he thought she was feisty, funny, a tough chick, athletic and capable, the sort of girl you could take to the football or camping. And he was right. She was exactly that type of girl. She was into her sport. She loved camping and she was never high maintenance or needy. The opposite. She found it hard to admit she needed anyone or anything. When they first started going out, she once broke her toe trying to move a bookshelf on her own when Napoleon was on his way over and could have lifted that piece of plywood junk with one hand. But no, she had to do it herself. The fragility beneath that feisty demeanor came out slowly, in odd ways. A peculiar attitude towards certain foods that may have just been a sensitive stomach, but may have been something more. An inability to make eye contact if an argument got too emotional, or to say, I love you, without bracing her chin as if she were preparing to be punched. He'd thought, romantically, that he could keep her funny, fragile little heart protected, like a tiny bird in the palm of his hand. He'd thought, full of love and testosterone, that he would protect his woman from bad men and heavy furniture and upsetting food. When he first met her odd, detached parents, he understood that Heather had grown up starved of love. And when you're starved of something you should receive in abundance, you never quite trust it. Heather's parents weren't abusive, but they were just chilly enough to make you shiver. Napoleon became excessively loving in their presence, as if he could somehow make them love his wife the way she should be loved. Doesn't Heather look great in this dress? He'd say. Did Heather tell you she came top in her midwifery exam? Until one day, Heather mouthed the words, stop it. So he stopped it, but he still touched her more than usual whenever they visited her family, desperate to convey through his touch, you are loved. You are loved. You are so, so loved. He'd been too young and happy to know that love wasn't enough. Too young to know all the ways that life could break you. Their son's death broke her. Maybe a son's death broke any mother. The anniversary was tomorrow. Napoleon sensed its dark, malignant shadow. It was irrational to feel frightened of a day. It was just a sad day, a day they were never going to forget anyway. He reminded himself that this was normal. People felt like this on anniversaries.
He'd felt this same impending sense of doom last year, almost as if it were going to happen again, as if this were a story he'd read before and he knew what lay ahead. He'd hoped that doing this retreat might make him feel calmer about the approach of the anniversary. It was a marvelous house, so peaceful and, yes, tranquil, and the staff seemed kind and caring. Yet Napoleon felt skittish. At dinner last night, his right leg had begun to tremble uncontrollably. He'd had to put a hand on his thigh to still it. Was it just the anniversary? Or the silence? Probably the silence. He didn't like having all this time with only his thoughts, his memories, and regrets. The sun rose higher in the sky as the Tranquillum House guests moved in unison with Yao. Napoleon caught a glimpse of the profile of the big, chunky guy who had tried to smuggle in the contraband. It had seemed like he might be a troublemaker, and Napoleon had kept his teacher's eye on him. But he appeared to have settled down. Like one of those students you thought was going to be your nemesis for the whole year, but then turned out to be a good kid. There was something about this guy's profile that reminded Napoleon of somebody or something from his past. An actor from some old TV show he used to enjoy as a child, perhaps? It felt like a good memory. There was something pleasant about the feelings he invoked. But Napoleon couldn't put his finger on it. Somewhere in the distance, a whipbird called. He loved the sound of the whipbird, that long, musical crack of the whip that was so much a part of the Australian landscape you had to leave the country to realise how much you missed it, how it settled your soul. "Repulse the monkey," said Yao. Napoleon repulsed the monkey and remembered 3 years ago. This day, this time, the day before. It was around this time, 3 years ago, that Napoleon was making love to his sleepy wife for the last time in their marriage. He assumed it was the last time, although he hadn't given up entirely. He would know if she was ever ready. All it would take would be a look. He understood. Sex felt cheap now, tawdry and tacky. But he'd still be up for some cheap, tawdry sex. She'd fallen asleep again. She used to love her sleep back then. And Napoleon had quietly left the house and headed for the bay. He kept the surf ski on the roof rack of his car throughout the long summer holiday. When he came back, Zack was eating breakfast at the sink, shirtless. He was always shirtless, hair sticking up in tufts. He looked up, grinned at his father and said, "No milk," meaning he'd drunk it all. He said that he might come with Napoleon for a paddle the next day. After that, Napoleon worked for a few hours in the garden and cleaned the pool, and Zack went to the beach with his friend Chris, and then Napoleon fell asleep on the couch and the girls went out, Heather to work, Zoe to a party. When Zack came home, Napoleon did ribs on the barbecue for the two of them. And afterwards they had a swim in the pool and talked about the Australian Open and Serena's chances and conspiracy theories. Zack liked conspiracy theories. And how Chris had told Zack he wanted to go into gastroenterology. Zack was gobsmacked by the bizarre specificity of Chris's career plans because Zack didn't even know what he wanted to do tomorrow, let alone for the rest of his life. And Napoleon told him that was fine. There was plenty of time to settle on a career, and these days no one had just one career anyway. He absolutely told him it was fine. He double-checked his memory about 1,000 times, And then they played table tennis in honor of the tennis, best of three, Napoleon won two. And then they watched a movie, The Royal Tenenbaums. They both loved the movie. They laughed a lot. They stayed up too late watching the movie. That's why Napoleon was tired the next morning. That's why he hit the snooze button on his phone. It was a split-second decision he would regret until the day he died. Napoleon knew everything about that day because he'd examined his memories over and over, like a homicide detective combing through the evidence. Over and over, he saw it, his hand reaching for the phone, his thumb on the snooze button. Over and over, he saw the other life, where he made a different decision, the right decision, the decision he normally made, where he didn't hit snooze, where he turned off the alarm and got out of bed. "Grasp the bird's tail," said Yao. It was Heather who found Zack. The sound of his wife's scream that morning was like no sound he'd ever heard before. His memory of running up the stairs, it seemed like it took a lifetime, like running through mud, like something from a dream. Zack had used his new belt to make the noose. It was a brown leather belt from R.M. Williams that Heather had bought him for Christmas only a few weeks earlier. It cost $99, which was ridiculous. "Expensive belt," Napoleon had said to Heather when she showed it to him. He remembered fishing the receipt from the plastic bag, raising his eyebrows. She shrugged. Zack had admired it once. She overspent every Christmas. "You broke your mother, mate." The kid did not leave a note or a text. He did not choose to explain his actions. "Carry the tiger over the mountain," said Yao, who was a young man, maybe only 10 years older than Zack. Zack could have worked somewhere like this. He could have grown his hair long. He would have looked good with one of those beards they all had these days. He could have lived a fantastic life, so many opportunities. He had the brains, the looks, the facial hair. He was good with his hands. He could have done a trade. He could have done law or medicine or architecture. He could have traveled. He could have done drugs. Why didn't he just do drugs? How wonderful to have a son who made bad choices but not irreversible bad choices. A kid who did drugs, who dealt drugs even, who got arrested, who went off the rails. Napoleon could have got him back on the rails. Zack never even owned his own car. Why would you choose to die before you knew the pleasure, the spectacular pleasure of owning your own car? Apparently that young bloke in front of him drove a Lamborghini. Zack had chosen to turn his back on this beautiful world of whipbirds and Lamborghinis, long-legged girls and hamburgers with the lot. He chose to take a gift from his mother and use it as a murder weapon. That was a bad choice, son. It was the wrong thing to do. It was a really bad choice. He heard a sound and realized it was him. Zoe turned to look at him. He tried to smile at her reassuringly. "I'm fine, Zoe, just yelling at your brother." His eyes blurred. "Needle at the bottom of the sea," said Yao. "My boy. My boy. My boy." He was not broken. He would never stop grieving for Zach, but he had made a decision in the week after the funeral. He must not break. It was his job to heal, to be there for his wife and his daughter, to get through this. So he studied the literature. He bought books online and read every word. He downloaded podcasts. He Googled the research. He attended the Tuesday night Survivors of Suicide group as faithfully as his mother once went to Sunday Mass, and now he ran the group. Heather and Zoe thought he talked too much, but that was only in social situations. On Tuesday nights, he hardly spoke a word. He listened and he listened on his fold-out chair and did not flinch while a tsunami of pain crashed all around him. He gave speeches to parent groups and schools and did radio interviews and edited an online newsletter and helped with fundraising. It's his new hobby. He'd overheard Heather say that on the phone one night to someone. He never found out to whom because he never mentioned it, but he never forgot it. Or the bitter tone. It sounded close to hatred. It hurt because it was both a malicious lie and the shameful truth. He could find hatred in his heart for her, too, if he went looking for it. The secret of a happy marriage was not to go looking for it. He saw his wife's thin arms curved up towards the sun to master its life force, and his heart filled with painful tenderness for her. She could not heal, and she refused to even try. She never went to the support group except for that one time. She did not want to hear from other parents who had lost sons because she believed Zach was superior to their stupid sons. Napoleon thought Zach was superior to their stupid sons too, but he still found solace in giving back to this community he had never asked to join. The white crane spreads its wings. Sometimes there are no signs. That's what he told the newly grieving parents at the Tuesday night group. He told them there was research to suggest that teenage suicide was often the consequence of an impulsive decision. Many had suicidal thoughts for only 8 hours before their attempts. Some idiotic kids put as little as 5 minutes thought into their catastrophic choice. He did not tell them other things he had learned from his research, such as that suicide survivors often reported that their first thought after they'd swallowed the pills, after they'd jumped, after they'd cut, was a version of, "My God, what have I done?" He did not tell them that many survivors of suicide are transformed by their experience and go on to live happy lives, sometimes with little psychiatric intervention. He didn't tell them that if the decision to take their lives was in some way thwarted, if the means was removed, their suicidal thoughts often disappeared with time and never returned. He didn't tell them how Britain's national suicide rate dropped by a third when coal gas was phased out, because once people no longer had the option to impulsively stick their head in the oven, there was time for their dark and dreadful impulses to pass. He didn't think it was helpful for parents to know just how much bad luck was involved in the loss of their children. That perhaps all they'd needed was a well-timed interruption, a phone call, a distraction. But Napoleon knew it because that was Zach. Impulsive. The absolute definition of impulsive. He never thought things through. He never thought of the consequences of his actions. He lived in the moment, as you were meant to do. He practiced mindfulness, no yesterday, no tomorrow, just now. I feel this now, so I will do this now. If you chase the waves along the beach, your new runners will get wet, and they will stay wet for the rest of the day. If you run about outside when the pollen count is high, even though we told you to stay indoors, you will have an asthma attack. If you give up your life, you won't get it back, kid. It's gone. Zach, you've got to think, Napoleon used to yell at him. That's why Napoleon knew without a doubt that if he'd got up at the time he'd originally planned, if he hadn't pressed the snooze button on his alarm that morning, if he'd knocked on Zach's door and said, "Come paddling with me," then right now he'd have a wife who wasn't broken and a daughter who still sang in the shower and a son about to celebrate his 21st birthday. Napoleon was meant to be the one who knew and understood boys. He had a drawer full of cards and letters from the boys he'd taught over the years and their parents, all telling him how very special he was, how much he'd contributed to their lives, that they would never forget him, that he'd pulled them back from some terrible brink, a wrong path, that they'd be eternally grateful to their wonderful teacher, Mr. Marconi. Yet he'd somehow failed his own boy, the only boy in the world who mattered. For a year, he'd searched for answers. He'd talked to every friend, every teammate, every teacher, every coach. None of them had answers. There was nothing more to know. "Fan through the back," said Yao. Napoleon fanned through the back and felt his muscles stretch and the sun warm on his face as he tasted the sea from the tears that ran heedlessly down his face. But he wasn't broken. Chapter 27. Zoe. Zoe saw the tears slide down her father's face and wondered if he knew he was crying. Her dad cried a lot without seeming to realize he was doing it, like a scratch he didn't know was bleeding, as if his body excreted grief without his knowledge. "Touch the sky," said Yao. Zoe followed the graceful arc of Yao's arms and turned now in her mother's direction and saw the deep crevices in her mother's face and heard once more the sound of her mother's scream that awful morning, like the scream of an animal caught in a trap, a scream that tore straight through Zoe's life like a razor blade. Tomorrow it would be 3 years. Would it ever get any easier for her parents? Because it sure didn't look like it was getting any easier. There was no use hoping that once they got through this next anniversary, things would get better, because she'd thought that the last two anniversaries. She knew that when they went back home, it would all be just the same. It felt like her parents were sick with a terrible, incurable disease that ravaged their bodies. It felt like they'd been assaulted, as if someone had come after them with a baseball bat. She had not realized that grief was so physical. Before Zach died, she thought grief happened in your head. She didn't know that your whole body ached with it, that it screwed up your digestive system, your menstrual cycle, your sleep patterns, your skin. You wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. Sometimes it felt like Zoe was just waiting out her life now, enduring it, ticking off events and days and months and years, as if she just had to get herself through something unspecified and then things would be better. Except she never got through it, and it never got better, and she would never forgive him. His death was the ultimate fuck you.
At least you weren't close, said her friend Kara in her head.
At least we weren't close. At least we weren't close. At least we weren't close.
Chapter 28. Heather. Heather didn't see Napoleon's tears as they did Tai Chi. She was remembering something that had happened last week after a long, exhausting night shift when she'd helped to deliver two baby boys. It was impossible not to think of Zach every time she held another newborn baby boy and stared into those sad, wise eyes. All babies had that same wise look, as if they'd just come from another realm where they'd learned some beautiful truth they couldn't share. Every day brought an endless stream of new life. Heather had gone to get her coffee from the hospital cafe after her shift and run into a familiar face from the past. There was no time to turn away and pretend she hadn't seen. She recognized her instantly. One of the soccer mums. Before Zach gave it up. Lisa somebody. A friendly, bubbly lady. It had been years. Lisa somebody's face lit up when she saw Heather. Oh, I know you. And then, as so often happened, a moment later her face fell as she remembered what she'd heard on the grapevine. You could virtually read her thoughts. Oh, fuck, she's that mother. But no time to look away. Some people crossed the street to get away from her. She'd seen them do it. Some people recoiled. They literally recoiled, as if what had happened to Heather's family was vile and shameful. This woman was one of the brave ones. She didn't duck or hide or pretend. I'm so sorry to hear about Zach, she said. She even said his name without lowering her voice. Thank you, said Heather, longing for coffee. She looked at the boy standing next to her on crutches. This must be... Justin? The name came to her on a flood of memories of shivering Saturday mornings on the soccer field. And suddenly, without warning, the anger exploded in her chest, and this kid, this living, stupid kid, was her target. I remember you, she hissed at him. You were the kid who never passed to Zach. He stared at her with blank, slack-jawed horror. You never passed to Zach. Why didn't you pass? Heather turned to Lisa. You should have made him pass. Her voice rose beyond the bounds of what was acceptable in a public place. Most people would have made their excuses and scurried away. Some people might have retaliated. Your dead son doesn't give you the right to be rude. But this Lisa, this woman Heather barely knew, a woman who, Heather now remembered, had once taken Zoe home to her place and fed her lunch after Zach had an asthma attack on the field, just looked at Heather steadily and sadly and said, You're right, Heather. I should have made him pass. And then Justin, who had been 9 years old when he played with Zach, had spoken up in his deep young man's voice and said, Zach was a great striker, Mrs. Marconi. I should have passed to him more. I used to be really bad at passing the ball. The generosity, the kindness, the maturity that young man showed that day. Heather had looked at his face, the freckles on his nose, the tiny black whiskers around his young boy's mouth, and seen the grotesque face of her son on the last day of his life.
I'm so sorry, she'd said, weak and trembling with regret. And she'd left without making further eye contact with either of them, without picking up her coffee. Yet again, she'd turned the anger that should have been directed only at herself on someone else.
Snake creeps through the grass, said Yao.
She saw herself sitting alone in Zach's room, her hand opening the drawer of his bedside cabinet. Heather was the snake that crept through the grass.